pleasure it is in all. And you know him well, so we can keep him in our life. A lot of great important, which he speculates was instrumental in getting his job in National Review, since he had a lot of great department, as a bachelor's degree department. As far as he knows, he's the only department graduate. He worked for Bill Buckley at National Review, and then he came to Washington for the Reagan administration, held several positions, including as chairman of the FTC. Currently, he's a distinguished fellow at the Heritage Foundation and the International Affairs. I want to tell a little anecdote about Dan, a little story about our years together at the Education Department, which served two purposes. One, being to acknowledge the personal debt to Dan, which he's probably not intended to aware of. When the Reagan administration put together a team for the Education Department, it was a little misstep at the beginning, resulting in the appointment of Ted Bell. Some of us ran to the rescue and basically tried to put together a team to give Secretary Bell some help in remembering the Reagan agenda. Dan Oliver was one of the key players in this scenario. And we, in fact, had a fairly solid team of second and third level people, a very fine conservative team, whose daily job was to remind Ted because he had a much larger team of career civil servants and some political appointees who reminded him daily of what Congress and the association was there. Well, this created a certain amount of tension, you might expect, in meetings and of all kinds, confrontations resulted. And the tension tended to grow over the months and years. And after a couple of years of this little warfare, it came to a head one day in a controversy that Dan was very much at the center of over the proper interpretation of the authority and the role of the advisory council to the National Institute of Education, of which George Rush was the chairman. Dan had the audacity to give Ted Bell his separate opinion as general counsel for the department as to what the law said. And Ted Bell said, well, gee, Dan, thank God I didn't ask. And can you take it back? Dan said, well, you can disregard. I didn't fully advise counsel, but that's my opinion. This somehow got into the newspapers, and once things get public, something has to give, and the secretary started maneuvering to have Dan eased out of the department, which, of course, he probably didn't be doing for several months, anyway. And it was getting very, very tense. There were all kinds of players, all kinds of discussions going on with many people in the department and the White House, trying to find a solution to this crisis. And I finally decided that I might as well take advantage of the situation and find some way to piggyback on Dan's martyrdom here. So I sent a message by way of a personal friend of Ted Bell's to the secretary one afternoon, and I said to them, I really hate to tell you this, but if Dan leaves the department, I'll have to do this. And the scenario worked. That only hastened the secretary's desire to resolve the situation. Dan did not back down. The secretary did not back down. And Dan shortly thereafter left for Terry Glory. And very shortly thereafter, I fulfilled my commitment. Therefore, I want to acknowledge my debt to Dan, liberated me from the Department of Education and Ted Bell. Dan Oliver.
Somewhere while the statute of limitations ran. We get out in a flat on the avenue of President Kennedy, where I think I know what the thing we didn't become fluent in French, but we discovered you really don't have to. English, it turns out, is the lingua franca of Europe, which I think doesn't totally please Franklin's. There is the story of the French businessman making a presentation to some potential American customers. He gets stuck in mid-sentence, turns to his French colleague, and asks, "How do you say cash flow in English?" The answer is, you swallow your pride the same way you do when you ask, who quieted the Western Front in World War I, or who liberated Paris in World War II, or who beat the Somme at the Somme Center. But I'm ahead of myself. I want to say a few words about political and economic integration in Europe, the essence of political correctness, PC, in Europe today. But before I do that, I want to correct the title of my speech that Don Woodson created on your programs, Over Here, Over There. That's a mistake. It should have been Over There, Over Here. The confusion arose because when I suggested the title of Don, I was over there. Americans, and particularly believers in limited government, who find the debate on Europe 1992 familiar and frustrating. Advocates of limited government, which I assume members of this progressive society to be, are faced with two questions. What is proper government, and how do you limit the power of that government? Now, a related but different question, how do you limit corruption in government, has been definitively answered by the Philadelphia Society's own Tim Wheeler, whose solution is, the way to eliminate corruption in high places is to eliminate high places. Exactly. But how do you eliminate high places? How do you limit the high power of government, even a good government? At the Montpelier Society meeting in Munich last September, Nobel Prize winner James Buchanan suggested that a central provision of any newly formed European community should be the freedom to secede, an arresting suggestion coming from America. Is there any better way to encourage the observance of all the contractual guarantees of freedom than to provide the right to pick up the baton ball and go home if you don't like the way the game is being played? Certainly, the threat of secession is one way to limit Leviathan, that ever-hungry, never-stated bureaucratic monster in presence of developed freedom. Limiting the lesser Leviathans was the original goal of the U.S. Constitutional Convention, as Ronald Reagan remembers. That convention was called to promote freer trade, to eliminate the barriers to trade erected by the several states to protect their citizens' special interests. Post-World War II Europe was a bit like revolutionary America, but with many more economic restrictions. People were required to have passports to travel between the European states, goods were subject to at least customs inspection at borders, and some countries had currency controls. The so-called single market of 1992 is an attempt to solve the problems created by those restrictions. But the attempts to integrate have led to endless debate. Not all people in Europe are enthusiastic about giving Brussels bureaucrats political power over decisions that individual states think they can make perfectly well on their own. Well, that sounds like a fight over federalism, and in a sense it is. But federalism turns out to be a two-edged sword. We Reaganauts use federalism as a tool to chop power away from the central government. The bigger Europeans, however, use federalism as an argument in favor of taking power away from the states and centralizing it in Brussels. Our federalism diffuses, their federalism centralizes. We here are narrowly for decentralization, yet even we are used to thinking that foreign policy should be made only by the national government, not, say, Massachusetts or Minnesota. But when you're taking power away from sovereign nations, centralizing becomes a sort of global village, indeed global loaning. Would Britain really cede foreign policy decisions to Brussels? If federalism precludes Britain from and decided on our own to lift sanctions on South Africa, or to adopt a nuclear policy, system on other European countries, or to include the ally in Operation Desert Shield, then Britons, or at least some Britons, who reject federalism to call their renowned sovereignty. Even Foreign Secretary Hood has said that Britain will continue to oppose the creation of a single European defense policy and oppose the extension of majority voting in our policy. Different nationalities seem to want different foreign policies. But despite their different nationalities, Europeans are sometimes said to share a common culture, perhaps. Why is it then that the Germans, who have lived next door to the French for, oh, 1,000 years or so, still can't cook? Sure, they live next door to each other, but so do the people in the New York City apartment building. When you drive in France, you're lucky if you can ever get anyone to pump gas for you, especially if it's raining. In Germany, however, they'll not only pump gas, they'll wash your windows, even if it is raining. On the other hand, Louise and I, two of our children, arrived one night in Heidelberg about 9 o'clock in the evening, booked a room and proceeded to the dining room, and we were told that the kitchen closed at 10. We finished our main course about an hour later and asked what to do. The waiter looked down at us and announced the kitchen was closed. Oh, yes, I showed him my watch and pointed out that it was only just after 10. That kitchen is closed. Yes, I said, the children are hungry, we've come along, that kitchen is closed. We were not able to get dessert that night because the kitchen had transpired was closed. The Europeans themselves are well aware of the differences and tell what I suppose we would call ethnic jokes about each other. The Americans tell ethnic jokes too, and we joke that they're not listening. But only about foreigners, not about people from our own states, except in the case of Massachusetts. And even then, the only joke I can remember is about this Greco-American who drives around in a tank wearing a funny helmet. The Europeans have a little more bite. A British joke asks, why do the French plant long alleys of trees down the sides of their road? The answer they give with a chuckle is, so the German army can march in the shade. Another one concerns what one Englishman I know calls the alphabet of shame. They assign to each letter of the alphabet a moment of history the French would like to forget at the end. Telephone doctor. Operator. Information. Caller. Operator, I'd like the number for Mr. P.M. Ball. Operator. How do you spell that, sir? Caller. Operator, that's P as in Marshal Patan, M as in Maginot, B as in Vichy, not Dumbledore, as in Waterloo. A as in Agincourt, L as in Laval, D as in France. The economic debate in Europe may be somewhat easier for us to understand. France has been the leading proponent of an integrated European economy, but the French idea of how to manage an economy is different from the English way. Current president of France, Francois Mitterrand, after taking a look over a year ago at Mrs. Thatcher's economically revived England, announced that the heyday of liberal, free market, heyday of liberal philosophies and economics is ending. That's not the way Mrs. Thatcher or her disciples see it. They think the French see the European community as the last hope for creating true socialism. Mitterrand's comments provide support for the theory. One source of disagreement on economic policy in Europe has been the social charter, much loved by the French. It provides workers with certain rights for health and safety at work, training, and the right to work in any European country. The charter also guarantees workers participation in company management. But the provisions are controversial. And since Thatcher used to call the charter backdoor socialism, older workers in the American South may understand why she has been considered. One of the charter's provisions is for what is called upward harmonization of wages. That's Eurospeak for minimum wage. The people in Europe who want a minimum wage are the same kind of people who wanted a minimum wage in the US back in the 1950s. We call them Northerners. And the Northern Europeans want a minimum wage for the same noble reason our Northerners did, to keep jobs from going somewhere else, down south. Skills, and therefore wages, are lower in southern countries, as they were in the southern states of the U.S., and your minimum wage will exacerbate the unemployment problems of the southerners. That will tend to make evident the need for a policy of generous social benefits. That will create political pressures that tend to make currencies unsettled. Does any of this sound familiar? Those who do not live from history are condemned to repeat it, as it seems for those who do. Yet a paradox confronts the proponents of a weaker Brussels as it does the proponents of deregulation in the United States. Can a small central government control protectionism at the local level? During the Reagan administration, for example, the Justice Department and the Federal Trade Commission substantially deregulated antitrust. They lowered the level of government interference in the marketplace. The problem was, and remains, the deregulation of antitrust at the federal level seems to politicians at the state level to have created a power vacuum, or at least a career opportunity, in antitrust enforcement. In a number of major cases, state attorneys general and block committees at the federal authorities, after careful consideration, concluded would not allow their own competition. In Europe now, it looks as if authorities in Brussels will reject, or at least limit, the special interest protections proposals of automobile manufacturers. The automobile manufacturers in Europe would like to limit the imports of Japanese cars to no more than 15% of the market until the end of 1999. But Brussels is resisting. That's good news. And just last month, the European Court of Justice, contrary to the French government's wishes, reinforced Brussels' power to limit public service monopolies within the several European states. That's good news, too. Those are both pieces of good news, but they come from a bigger Brussels. The problem is how to give the national, Europe-wide government the power to deregulate, the power to take down the economic barriers to trade, without making it so strong that it can dictate, say, the size of each country's budget deficit. Or as Barry Goldwater might describe the dilemma, the government big enough to give you all the deregulation you want is big enough to take away your freedom. Unfortunately, for the cause of limited government in Europe, the disintegration of the Soviet Empire and the Desert War are not the only recent changes that will affect Europe. Or what that either, perhaps, was the removal of that most politically unpolitically correct politician, Margaret Thatcher, who dared to criticize the PC idea of European integration. I think it is not yet possible to say what the long-term effect of political policy will be. At the moment, Jacques Delors, the well-known French socialist and the most ardent promoter of European unity, seems to be in decline. That should assist the cause of the free market. Prime Minister John Major seems to be cozying up with the idea of the United States and Europe generally, and in particular with the Germans, whose economy will not receive a seal of approval from the Reagan regulator, the shortage of the French. The Anglo-French relationship may have cooled a bit, which would not be surprising after what the French did during the late Iraqi unpleasantness. The Prime Minister Major also seems to have abandoned, or at least to have abandoned articulating our principles and concerns his dispatch has about political union, concerns that arise from her understanding that it is limited government alone preserves freedom. For us, I think the question should always be, what is proper government? Is there an answer other than that government which promotes liberty and justice, including most especially a free market? Proper government is limited government, that government that governs least. It is not better management of big government. Promoters of good government remind us of those who, on hearing of the collapse of the Berlin Wall, mourned that true socialism limitations on government foster freedom by protecting people from government. If integrating Western Europe and forming a common market isn't about promoting freedom, what is it about? Why should anyone, except for the bureaucrat, want it? The trend today seems to be towards political independence, not integration. Secession may be making a comeback, and not only in the so-called Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, or in the Federated Yugoslavia, or in India, but even in Canada, who knows, maybe even in Vermont, too. In fact, the very idea of integrating politically is really quite anomalous in today's world, which should make us ask, is political integration really necessary for freeing up economics and trade in Europe? After all, U.S. and Canada concluded a treaty on free trade without the slightest suggestion of political integration. European businessmen I talked to said political integration was not necessary. They said businessmen were integrated years ago, by which they meant businessmen started years ago making plans to do business on a Europe-wide basis. Now, they told me, the politicians are just trying to catch up hold on. But if the politicians' goal in Europe is really free trade, why not include the Eastern Europeans as well? Will the Europeans succeed in uniting politically? My own guess today, and I hope, is no, at least not on important matters. For all their centers of being Europeans, whatever the Europeans are, they share no 4th of July. None of the modern European states was brought forth like America, conceived of liberty, and dedicated to the proposition of all men created equal. America has animating principles, and they are not part of history. They are current events. For the power to make tyrants tremble, empires crumble, to kindle hope and freedom-loving hearts everywhere. Ask the people of Eastern Europe who listened during the long night to American radio. I've talked to a number of them. They all said, keep American radio going. Americans, more it seems to me than most people, think about fundamental political values, the role of government, the goal of government. The Commonwealth Clause may have been lynched into a constitutional convention, but it's our commitments to rights and values, including the value of limited government, that gives America the heart and soul. During the Reagan years, America became freer and at the same time more prosperous. But it took the voice of that gifted man to sing the music that made America sound again. Europe has no such voice and no such music. And without that anthem, a new political unity over there may real significance seems unlikely. Meanwhile, over here, we must recognize reality. Many of the Reagan Revolution reforms seem to be unraveling. The special interest politics as usual types are crawling back out of their caves, well rested from their hibernation, proclaiming that big government can be good government. Taxes are up, as is federal spending, and the deficit, the minimum wage, the state is comparatively returns, deregulation is no longer there good. George Bush is a good man, and John Major is a decent man, too. They led us well, with courage to spare while bombs burst in the air. But taming that never-lean, always-hungry Leviathan requires a maestro's touch, a master's voice, and there is scant evidence they have it. Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher had it, but they are gone now. We knew, even while they led us, their days were numbered. I miss Ronald Reagan. And I miss Margaret Thatcher. Truly, they gave rebirth to freedom. And I pray their triumphs are not stillborn, not just some glorious holiday in history and statism. Gone they may be, but the winds that guided their ships of state to safe harbor, the warm winds that guide us, their heirs and disciples, in this small and faithful society. We know that freedom reigns in hearts and souls of men everywhere.